So, in the interests of having everybody still be able to stay awake by the end of the talk, I think it may be time to move on to our plenary lecture. It's my great pleasure to introduce Julian Jackson. Allow me to have this. Since Professor Jackson works in a field very remote from my own, my first reaction when trying to pull together information on him was to go look at reviews of some of his books. The first sentence of the first review that I looked at says this: this magnificent book should be the standard work in English on the French experience of the occupation. So I think that's a statistically valid indication of the position that Professor Jackson holds in the field in his profession. I can give you the basic statistics of his career. Professor Jackson is professor of modern French history and head of the School of History at Queen Mary University of London. He holds his PhD from Cambridge University. He is the author of numerous articles and also of numerous books. I can cite a few, from The Politics of Depression in France to The Popular Front in France, Defending Democracy, 1934 to 1938, France, The Dark Years, 1940 to 44, and then moving back in time, The Fall of France on 1939, and more recently, Living in Arcadia, Homosexuality, Politics, and Morality in France, From the Liberation to AIDS. He has produced an edited volume on the events of May 1968. He has been working on a biography of Charles de Gaulle, which is due out this summer from Penguin. He described it from Penguin in England and Harvard in the U.S. He describes it as big, so I think you should clear a substantial amount of space on your shelves for it. And is now moving on to another book on de Gaulle, to be called Thinking de Gaulle or De Gaulle For and Against, and perhaps after that, a book on the subject of today's lecture, which we will obviously get to in due course. His books have been translated into French, into Portuguese, into Czech, into Japanese, and quite possibly into other languages which I either did not notice or have forgotten. So his reputation is global. Beyond that, I will say very little. I leave you to draw your own conclusions. But I will say that looking through his works, a theme that immediately emerges is a recurring concern, not just with the traumatic experiences of the French mid-century, with depression, political and military collapse, the occupation, but with what the French have made of that trauma. And what that trauma has made of them. He's built a formidable reputation for the sensitive and subtle dissection of the ways more or less ordinary French people negotiated the difficult social and cognitive conditions created by the catastrophes of 1914 to 1945. And I think that that's the orbit that today's lecture, telling the truth about resistance, is going to be in. You will be discussing the career of Daniel Cordier, on whom I did some quick research and discovered that he's apparently a bizarre and fascinating figure. But I will leave that to Professor Jackson. And close by sharing another piece of my reading with you. In today's Guardian, I may not have been the only person who noticed this. There's an article which begins with the following sentence: Donald Trump's former advisor Steve Bannon has told France's far-right Front National that history is on our side and will bring us victory in an address to the party's conference. With apologies to whatever Steve Bannon superfans there may be here, I'm inclined to doubt that. Right? But nothing could better illustrate the urgency on both sides of the Atlantic of the project that Professor Jackson has undertaken, right, of understanding the history and the myths that have kind of created modern national and other identities, and of telling the truth about those myths and about the trauma that is often behind them. So with no further ado, I will turn it over to Professor Jackson. And I think you are to...
You need the microphone.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
This on.
Where does it go?
Just on your lapel.
All right, sorry. Sorry. We'll see. Is that okay?
That should be good.
Is the mic working? Is it? Yeah?
It just records.
So I will speak loud. Can you hear at the back? Yes? No? Oh, so there's no mic, basically. Okay, I'll speak loud. Can you hear now? So, anyway, thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you for having me here. I discovered to my surprise, horror, delight, whatever, that I'm visiting Pittsburgh on the same night as President Trump. Did you know that? I start with an apology, which is that I was asked, for obvious reasons, when I was invited to speak tonight, I was asked whether I would give a year ago. Yep. I was asked to speak about 1968, and I said I couldn't speak about 1968 because I hadn't really worked on it for 10 years, and I had nothing to say about it because I was working on De Gaulle, who's another side of 1968. So I was told, well, why can't you do De Gaulle in 1968? So I said, I'll do De Gaulle in 1968. Then I spent a lot of time thinking about that and realized there was nothing to say about De Gaulle in 1968 because De Gaulle was really absent in 1968. He just wasn't there. So that was a failed lecture, and I panicked and I said, can I do what I'm trying to work on at the moment, because I've been spending the last 4 years working on De Gaulle, and it is a big book. It's about 950 pages, so it is large, but I didn't want to talk about that really. So I'm talking today about something completely different, which is a kind of thing that I'm quite interested in and want to write about in the future. I'll read this lecture because partly I think it's always, I'll maybe say from total incoherence. So it's not so nice to have lectures read, but that's what I'm going to do. My subject is, as Johan said in his introduction, a man called Daniel Cordier, but he will become clear if you don't know who he is. So in November 1940, General de Gaulle created the Order of the Liberation to reward those fighting for the liberation of France. At a tricky moment in his very difficult relations with the British, he was assuming the regalian powers of a head of state to confer honours on French citizens. Mocked at first, the Order of the Liberation became and has become one of the most coveted and exclusive honours that could be awarded to any French citizen. It was awarded to only 1,038 individuals, and no new ones after de Gaulle left power in January 1946. Only eight Compagnons de la Libération are still alive, and one of those eight, of whom none has achieved greater celebrity, contemporary celebrity, than the 98-year-old Daniel Cordier, who served during the occupation as secretary to Jean Moulin, de Gaulle's delegate to the resistance. Since the moment in 1964 when de Gaulle chose to have Moulin transferred to the Pantheon to the accompaniment of a celebrated speech by André Malraux, everybody has presumably heard that speech, Moulin has assumed a legendary role in French memory as the unifier of the resistance. During the presidency of François Hollande, there was a campaign to pantheonize Pierre Brossolette, another great resistance figure who, like Moulin, had died at the hands of the Germans. But Brossolette had often clashed with Moulin. And Cordier was one of those who argued that for that reason it was inappropriate to transfer him also to the Pantheon. Though since the Pantheon accommodates both Voltaire and Rousseau, one might think that this such a cohabitation would not necessarily cause problems. In the end, Hollande, always seeking to dissolve conflict in fudge and compromise, diffused the controversy by pantheonizing four people, two men and two women in one batch. The first time this had ever been done, it's very typical of Hollande, he could never make up his mind, including Brosselet and the four other people. Cordier emerged into the limelight again in 2017 when he came out in support of Emmanuel Macron in the second round of the presidential election. He was among the guests invited to Macron's investiture at the Élysée on the 3rd of May, where Macron warmly embraced him, as if through the 98-year-old Cordier, Moulin was bestowing his benediction from the grave upon France's youngest ever president. A symbol both of the extraordinary fascination exercised by the personality of Moulin in France today and of the curious, unexpected, and relatively recent role that Cordier has come to assume in France today as Moulin's last representative on earth. And that's Macron embracing Cordier last year. My aim in this lecture is to examine the Cordier phenomenon, not just to tell the relatively well-known story of Cordier's life, but to use his life as a way of exploring the ways in which, over the last 70 years, historians have approached the writing of the history. I find Cordier fascinating as an example of slipperiness in self-presentation and in raising certain complex questions about how you write history and how you write the history of the resistance. The writing of the history of the resistance began during the occupation. That sounds a bit paradoxical, but from its inception, the resistance was largely about bluff. To exist, the resistance needed to proclaim that it existed when it was entirely imaginary. Thus, it wrote its history while making it. Resistors were also haunted by the idea that it was their duty to tell a story that, by its clandestine nature, might not leave any archives. Even before the whole of French territory had been liberated, de Gaulle's provisional government established a committee to start gathering documents relating to the history of the occupation. This became the famous Comité d'Histoire de la Deuxième Guerre Mondiale, which was a kind of semi-official organization depending on the Prime Minister and run by Henri Michel, a former resistor-turned-historian. Now, this organization had a network of local correspondents, and their role was to gather testimonies from resistors, and they were animated by a sense of a race against time to save the memory of the resistance. The aim was to interview everybody, the most humble agents of resistance, those who distributed tracts, liaison agents, radio operators, maquisards. Although presented as a raw material for future historians, the Comité believed it was already producing the history of the resistance in the raw because no future historian would be able satisfactorily to convey the extraordinariness of the resistance. Henri Michel wrote in 1956, "Studies must begin now, before the famous Recul de l'Histoire, because these events were so specific that only contemporaries will be able to convey them correctly, providing they were actors." So this idea that the resistance was too serious an affair to be left, the history of the resistance was too serious an affair to be left to the historians, was eloquently expressed by no less an authority than Lucien Febvre, officially president of the Comité, who wrote in a preface to a book by Michel that it was vital, that actors started to write this history, because when they were all dead, there would be the danger that historians would, once they were dead, once the ashes are cold, extract without burning their hands the cooked chestnuts of the official legend. On another occasion, Febvre wrote that history is made with life that is warm, providing that it is real life, that it is burning history. So the problem of the relationship between history and testimony, and the difficulty of conveying the authenticity of the experience of historical actors, was not, in fact, unique to the resistance. It had emerged already 30 years before, when the Franco-American university teacher, John Norton Crewe, published his extraordinary book, Témoin, which reviewed about 200 books about the experience of the Great War. And he judged them according to the authenticity of their descriptions. Even famous writers like Henri Barbusse found themselves excoriated for the implausibilities of their descriptions of the trench experience. Now, Crewe had fought on the Western Front, and it was thanks to this experience that he arrogated to himself the role of super témoin, the guardian of a true memory, rather like resistors after 1945, and with the same sense of moral urgency to transmit, in his words, the dépôt sacré de vérité que chacun porte en soi. Now, he was always a rather maverick figure, and I don't have time to go into him now. But after 1945, resistors and historians in France found themselves locked into a kind of wary complicity in their search for historical truth, with the historian resistor Henri Michel as the kind of gatekeeper, referee, watching over them. The attitude of many resistors was encapsulated in a book by the resistor Jean Cassou in 1951 called La Mémoire Courte, which argued that the French were in favor of forgetting and ignoring the lessons of the resistance, that there was a civic duty to tell the story. But at the same time, Cassou argued, totally contradictorily, it seems to me, that the resistance experience had been something unique, irreducible to any other reality, and therefore incommunicable. In a similar spirit, one of the most famous resistance leaders, Henri Frenet, had justified his refusal to write his memoirs in 1952 on the grounds that the resistance was his secret garden, which he did not want to be trampled by others. Thus, resistors were having it both ways, vigilant about the need to transmit their memory, while suggesting that it could not be transmitted because it was incommunicable. At a big conference to mark the 20th anniversary of the liberation in 1964, many of the usual suspects were present: historians, witnesses, and witness historians. The former number two of the movement Libération Sud, Pascal Copeau, spoke of his dissatisfaction that the writing of so many historians was dehumanized, figé, that it lacked lived reality. He said, "You must not be afraid to dip your pens in blood, because behind each of the acronyms that you explain with such book learning, there are comrades who are dead. And in reality, this was not the beautiful edifice that you think it was. It was the most fragile spider's web." Now, another resistor who became a very distinguished classical historian, Jean-Pierre Vernon, who was present at the same conference, took a slightly different view. He said, "It is not the ambition of historians to make the events of the past live again, to resuscitate them again in flesh and blood, so that witnesses feel they are back in the past. It is the task of the task of a work of art, a novel, a poem, a film. History tries to establish the facts in as exact and precise manner as possible, and to render them intelligible in their relationship to each other." It was at another of these rather tense encounters between historians and resistors, 10 years later, a bit more than 10 years later, that Daniel Cordier first presented his own findings on the resistance to a big conference at the Sorbonne, 1983. Now, many times since, Cordier, I showed you a moment ago, has told his story and why he found himself in this position. And I just summarize that for those who don't know him. His story runs basically as follows. Having served in the resistance during the war, still only 25 years old in 1945, he decided to put his wartime experiences behind him, and he embarked on an entirely new career as an art dealer. Very successful art dealer with galleries in Paris, New York, Frankfurt. He did not want, he said, to become like those veterans of the Great War who during his adolescence had paraded their sense of self-satisfaction and moral superiority in endless reminiscence. So apart from seeing one or two resistance comrades, he kept apart. He simply removed himself from the resistance milieu. But then, in 1977, he found himself invited to a big TV debate in a program I'm sure many of people here will remember from the old days, called Les Dossiers de l'Écran, when they used to show a film and then it would be followed by a big debate. And this was devoted to the resistance, and particularly to Moulin. And Cordier was invited. Among the other participants was Henri Frenet, who, in the previous year, before that debate, had published a book called L'Énigme Jean Moulin, alleging, among other things, that Moulin had been a crypto-communist. Now, this was Frenet's way of rationalizing the bitterness he felt at the way that Moulin had annexed the resistance to serve the interests of de Gaulle. The TV debate, and it's a great pity I don't have video here because I have a wonderful clip of the debate, which I can't show you, but the debate became extremely confused and extremely acrimonious. All the resistance leaders present, there were, That's the debate, so that's Cordier speaking at that debate. And so Frenet was there, Jean-Pierre Lévy, you may or may not know these names, depending on how well you know, but these are all big figures of the resistance. All the figures there had reservations about Frenet's claim that Moulin was a communist. No one really believed that. But they all had reservations about Moulin as the man who had tried to take over the resistance. So Cordier found himself completely isolated in his unconditional defense of his old patron Jean Moulin. He emerged from the encounter feeling humiliated that only a junior figure in the resistance, he'd been 23, 21, 22, 23, 24, who didn't even seem to be remembered by any of the other people present in the room, that he had no arguments to refute Frenet's allegations against Moulin. He felt he had let down Moulin. And so he decided to give up his life as a galeriste, and he'd made a lot of money, so he could do it, and devote himself, and I don't think he knew he was going to devote the rest of his life, to writing about Moulin, to refute the allegations of Frenet. Now, actually, for reasons I can't go into, I think that is a rather I think that his self-description rather smooths over a lot of complications which I don't have to go into here. I don't think he was quite the lamb led to the slaughter on that occasion that he claims. Whatever the truth, from that moment Cordier embarked on his 30-year quest to tell his truth about Moulin. So the former free French agent turned art dealer embarked on a third career as a historian. Starting with documents remaining in his possession since the war and with archives of the Gaullist intelligence services which were not yet declassified, for almost 10 years he worked on the Moulin case, painfully learning the historian's craft. It began as an attempt to refute the allegations of crypto-communism, but it swelled and swelled and swelled into an unwieldy monster of a book. And the conference at the Sorbonne in 1983 was the first time that Moulin presented his findings to an audience of his resistors and historians. He offered his own interpretation of the stormy relationship between Moulin and the resistance. The resistors in the audience, Freinet was not present, were angry that Cordier seemed to be relying on secret documents in his possession that no one else had seen. They felt that once again the resistance was being judged by bureaucrats from London, that is to say, you know, the Free French. But what really destabilized him was his claim that his documents offered him access to a higher truth than that offered by the memories and oral testimonies of the resistors. As he put it, "My testimony has no particular value. We must refer to the documents." And he enjoyed using his documents to catch resistors out. So at that debate, for example, he showed that the claims of the resistor Christian Pinault, founder of Liberation Nord, with whom he'd already crossed swords in that debate, he showed that Pinault's claim that he'd had no contact with Moulin before the spring of 1943 were disproved by documents which showed that Moulin and Pinault had met in 1942, and Pinault simply refused to believe him. Now, my own view, and again I can't go into this now, is that Cordier actually blurred that distinction between neo-positivist historian that he was arrogating to himself and witness. Because at one point in that debate, to someone who said they didn't recognize Moulin in his portrait, he said, "Well, I hope it will not shock someone who did not know Moulin that I am not surprised by this." In other words, I know Moulin, therefore I know better. So he was playing on two registers. But the most important thing is that Cordier offered not just an argument about Moulin, but a method, the primary of the document. He allowed... In practice, there were one or two qualifications to this extreme neo-positivistic approach. He allowed that testimonies were irrepressible to evoke the emotional quality of an event or the poetic aura of an era. On another occasion, I thought we had that quote. We don't. What's that? No, sorry. No, we don't. Sorry, I thought... Forget it. Another occasion, he compared the writing of history... He used a musical analogy, and he talked about writing the past to the improviser... He talked about the past... felt to him like the improvisation of a jazz orchestra whose instruments have been lost and of which a large part of the recordings have been destroyed. A concert that was only once played and that specialists now try to reconstitute, but no one will ever perceive in this music the particular sensibility of the musicians, etc., etc. Only those who were there will keep in their heads the fullness of the improvisation of this concert, etc. So he's playing on these two, but essentially he's asserting a position of extreme neopositivism. In 1989, Cordier published his two first massive volumes on Moulin. It was projected to be a six-volume biography. The publication resulted in another barrage of attacks from resistors, which I won't go into now, but I can talk about later if you want. He never finished the book on Moulin. He's still alive, but he has never finished it. A third volume came out in 1993, running to 1,300 pages. By then he realized that he was never going to finish, and so he instead produced another book about Moulin in 1999, which was a summary of all he'd done so far. And by then he had written 3,800 pages on Moulin, but never really got to the core of the events. Now, one might have thought that this would have ended the floodgates, would have ended the matter. But it only opened the floodgates to ever more books on Moulin. Here are a few. We have Moulin, the enemy of the resistance. Moulin, the ultra-gaullist. Moulin, the crypto-communist. Moulin, the Soviet spy. Moulin, planning to ditch de Gaulle in favor of the Americans. Moulin, the womanizer. Moulin, the homosexual. Now, the reasons for this insatiable obsession with Moulin are fascinating and, again, are not my preoccupation today. As far as Cordier is concerned, the tension between his dual role as actor and historian reached a paroxysm during the so-called Aubrac affair in 1997. Again, for those who don't know about this, its origins go back some years earlier. Raymond Aubrac and his wife Lucy were leaders of one of the most important resistance movements in the South, Libération Sud. Aubrac had been arrested along with Moulin on the 21st of June 1943. Unlike Moulin, he survived and he escaped from jail thanks to a daring raid organized by his wife Lucy. All this came back into the public mind in 1983 when Klaus Barbie, the former Gestapo chief who had arrested and tortured Moulin, was extradited from Argentina to be tried in France. The strategy of the Defense Council was to discredit the resistance by alleging there was proof that Moulin had been betrayed by resistors, including Aubrac. In the end, all that fizzled out. But the Aubracs were now in a limelight in a way they'd never been before. In 1984, Lucy Aubrac published a lively memoir of her life in the resistance, focusing on her rescue of Raymond. And then it was... Now, what's interesting about her book, it was cast in the form of a... this one here, Il Patron dans l'Ivresse, which is translated in English as Outwitting the Gestapo. It was cast in the form of a journal, a day-by-day journal. That was, it was a fictitious journal, but that was the form, the literary form she chose. Its spectacular success resulted in a film starring Carole Bouquet in 1997. But almost immediately at that moment, a muckraking amateur historian produced a book on the resistance which resurrected Barbie's allegations against the Aubracs. And this book by Gérard Chauvy was at least able to show that there were many discrepancies in the Aubracs' account. So rather than suing Chauvy, the Aubracs asked for their case to be discussed by a round table of historians organized by the newspaper Libération in 1997. Now that lasted for a day, but it took a turn that no one had predicted. Now, no historian present, and I should say among the historians present, was Daniel Cordier. Whether he was there as a historian or a témoin is always the problem. But the discussion, no one credited the more scurrilous accusations that Aubrac had betrayed Moulin. No one believed that. But the discussion quickly moved to the many inconsistencies in the various accounts that the Aubracs had given of their resistance experiences. And no one was more forensic and more vicious, you might say, in the attack on the Aubracs than Cordier. And I suppose I could have read this in French, but I've translated it. And I won't read the whole thing, but you can read it. But the burden of what Cordier was saying was, the key bit is, it's all very well, I want to defend you, but there's so many inconsistencies. To defend you, I finally prefer to rely on documents to prove your innocence rather than on your arguments. You are certainly not guilty, but your defense disappoints me and does you no good. I can only think of Zola's comment after the Dreyfus affair, it's enough to put you off the innocent. Lucy says, I'm not here to defend myself. He says, but you are being attacked. Raymond, admitting you will not defend yourself, it is the duty of historians to defend you, etc. Reading the documents by Chauvy, we are amazed by the contradictions and we wonder if you are hiding something. What can I reply to journalists who ask me? I know you are not hiding any betrayal, but I ask myself what other thing you are trying to hide. It seems to me behind this there is something you do not want to admit. This makes me sad, and I repeat my question, what are you trying to hide? Now, the passion of that debate caused scars in the French historical profession that still exists today. I mean, I know French historians who are present on either side who simply will, I think almost cross the street rather than speaking to each other. I mean, it caused a deep, deep division, those who pushed the Aubracs and those who defended them. One unrepentant participant was Henri Rousseau. And Rousseau afterwards wrote a book about the whole affair, among other things. And he said about Lucy Aubrac that she deserves our respect for her action in the war, but she cannot forbid historians the right to object to her present conception of the memories of the resistance. As he said, the Aubracs committed the mistake of thinking it would be easy to intimidate and instrumentalize historians. But what made it possible for historians, and Rousseau among them, to take up this stance was, as Cordier himself wrote, his work had served to liberate historical research from the crushing authority of the témoignage of the Grand Résistant. Now, again, I'm going to cut here, but there's a lot to be said about Cordier's very complex relationship with the historical profession. Jean-Pierre Azimat, who I'm sure everybody knows the name of here, Azimat was planning to write, before Cordier entered the scene, a biography of Moulin himself, which he abandoned and decided to support Cordier in his writing of his book. And so Cordier gave Azimat a kind of legitimacy, whereas, Cordier gave Azimat the legitimacy of the man who had the documents who'd been in the period. Azimat gave Cordier the legitimacy of the historical profession. So they are parasitic upon each other in some sort of way. And then eventually Azimat wrote a good biography of Moulin, which was simply a synthesis of the 3,800 pages of Cordier. So that's where we are. But then, in a startling turn of events, in 2009, Cordier, the fanatically neo-positivist historian, who had only rarely intruded himself into the history he'd been writing, published 900 pages, he never writes short, 900 pages of memoirs under the title Alias Caracalla, covering 3 years from the fall of France in June 1940 to the death of Moulin in June 43. So the historian now mutated into memorialist. Having acquired through his historical work on the resistance, a legitimacy second to none. He now capitalized on that unique status to produce his own testimony. About a word about the book, Alias Caracalla, which I think is a kind of masterpiece in a way. It starts with the day when Cordier got on a boat on the 20th of June 1940, thinking he was heading to North Africa to go on fighting, and instead he found himself heading to Great Britain, where he eventually joined de Gaulle's secret services. He trained in the arts of being a secret agent and was parachuted into France in July 1942. His mission was to become the radio operative to Georges Bidault, a resistor in France, and to be Bidault's link to London. But he was also told to begin his mission by delivering some documents to Moulin in Lyon. Their first meeting on the 30th of July 1942 was the turning point in Cordier's life. Moulin, having no team around him, immediately, as it were, kidnapped Cordier and designated him to become his assistant. And for the next 11 months, Cordier lived in daily proximity to Moulin, decoding his messages from London, coding the replies, organizing his meetings with resistance leaders, finding him places to hide, distributing funds to resistance leaders, carrying messages to politicians, but also preparing his breakfast and reading his mail. Few people lived in greater proximity to Moulin than Cordier in this period, and Alias Caracalla offers an intimate, human, and touching portrait of Moulin. I think it is a deeply moving book. It's also a kind of Bildungsroman. It's a narrative of self-education. He recounts his personal evolution from having been a young man of the extreme right, a Marassian, brought up to hate the Republic and the Jews, and believing that his decision to leave France was the only way of being faithful to those values. Gradually, his own experiences, his encounters with the Free French, with people from backgrounds entirely different from his own, lead the impressionable and passionate young man, barely out of adolescence, to reject the values in which he had believed. One moment of epiphany is when he arrives in occupied Paris in March 43, and he sees for the first time an old Jewish man wearing a yellow star, and he realizes in this moment of objection where all his learnt anti-Semitism had led in practice. Cordier's daily proximity to the fiercely Republican and left-wing Moulin is another part of that process of self-education and the development of a new identity. In many other ways also, Moulin influences Cordier's future through their many conversations about art. Moulin was an amateur artist, passionate collector of modern art. One of his covers during the resistance was a gallery that he ran in Nice. And they would have endless conversations about art, about which Cordier knew absolutely nothing. And then if, after the war, Cordier, totally ignorant about art, became a dealer after the war, it was another way of being loyal to his mentor, guru, and father figure, Jean Moulin. Quite apart from what it tells us about Moulin and Cordier, Alias Caracalla is also a fascinating document of major historical significance. No one has better conveyed the intense passion of the exiguous band of first Free French recruits, their burning desire to fight, their intense sense of comradeship, their bouts of homesickness, their growing admiration for the phlegmatic British, and their almost mystical reverence for de Gaulle. No one has better portrayed the daily life of a Free French agent in the constant sense of tension, the fear, the loneliness, the isolation in which resistors lived from each other, even if they were only, in fact, living two or three houses apart. There are wonderful tiny details which illuminate the daily problems of resisting in a period of such scarcity in France. For example, Moulin, Cordier had to spend his whole day moving around Lyon. And as one day he said to Moulin, could you authorize a purchase of a bike out of funds sent from London? Moulin says, yes, you can buy a bike. He buys the bike. 3 days later, the bike is stolen. He goes to Moulin and says, my bike's been stolen. Moulin says, okay, buy another bike. He buys another bike. And then 6 months later, that bike is stolen. And Moulin says, from now on, you'll have to walk. So it's full of concrete details. It's also full of revealing anecdotes about the ambiguities of occupied France. For example, the Parisian family who had fled to Lyon, the Moret, offered Cordier a lot of support, and they put him up because they want to help the resistance. But that does not help them, that does not prevent them being ardent Pétainists. One night, Madame Moret, who is harbouring at the risk of her life, this agent from London, tells Cordier she was worried that she had been worried on the first day that he might be a Jew, and was relieved to find that he wasn't a Jew. But this didn't stop her having a cult for Pétain as a savior in France, and she saw no contradiction between admiring Pétain and harboring Cordier. Now, this fascinating memoir is cast in the form of a daily journal, but a fictitious one. The parts that cover Cordier's time in Britain between June 40 and July 42 are drawn from a real memoir, because obviously he was able to keep one. But once in France, it was much too dangerous to do this. So Cordier's journal, alias Caracalla, is an entirely literary construction similar to that which Lucy Aubrac had chosen for her own memoirs earlier. Now, this raises in the mind of the reader how Cordier, how anyone, could at a distance of 70 years remember in such detail almost every moment of his activity. For example, the entry on the 11th of December 1942, we have a description in minute detail, lasting 20 pages, of a meeting organized by Moulin with a top group of socialists. And Cordier remembers seems to remember and reconstruct the intervention of every protagonist. In many conversations, we are presented with characters telling each other things which they would surely have known, like those historical films where somebody said, oh, Julius Caesar, Emperor of Rome. You know, you have to say who is who. So sometimes Cordier is less the memorialist than the scenarist of his own story. And indeed, there was a plan to make the film, the memoir, into a book, but Cordier wanted such tight control over it that the film was never made. There are wonderfully vivid conversations. One day, Cordier says to Moulin, how can the people support Pétain, the man of capitulation to de Gaulle, the solitary leader of resistance who has saved the honor of France? And Moulin replies, for the most people, the honor of France is no consideration. Another day, he reports Moulin furiously saying, I can no longer do anything with Frenier and Astier. I will send them to London, and a general will sort them out. Now the question is, how does anyone have the power of recall to reconstitute conversations in such detail? Now Cordier anticipates this criticism in three ways. One, having never written his memoirs before, he says his memories retain a kind of purity and intactness, unlike those, for example, of the Aubracs, who'd written so many versions. Secondly, he says that he had an exceptional memory. I think he does have a good memory, but nonetheless, you know. Thirdly, and this is interesting, I think, that the documents he had consulted during his historical researches, the documents, remember he's the man of documents, had produced a kind of Proustian involuntary memory in which the past suddenly came alive to him. He says, and that's the quotation here, thanks to the documents, the reality would live again, phrases conjured up like an echo, the presence, the principal echo, resurrected ghosts linked to certain decors, places, gardens, apartments. It was only when working on these documents I understood how much the resistance past buried in my blood would come alive for me in its all-enveloping passion. But he also admits that many of his reconstituted memories are approximations. Regarding one comment of something that Moulin said, he said, it remains engraved in my memory, unlike others, he said, where I am only giving the general sense, more or less ornamented by my imagination and my forgetfulness. On another occasion, he says, the words of Moulin at this point are true. He says, they're true in their general sense, but not their exact words. And in another moment, he says, I do remember this phrase exactly, to distinguish from when he doesn't. So how does Cordier do it? Presumably, he does it by going back to the documents. He goes back to the famous archives which underpinned his historical writing, and he then inserts himself in the archive. As it were, the actor behind the history reveals himself fully for the first time. Now, of course, Cordier had never hidden the fact that his metamorphosis into historian was motivated by his passion to defend Moulin. But once the metamorphosis had taken place, the passion had been kept under control behind the implacable mask of the document-obsessed positivist, no longer in the memoir. And there are two kinds of passion that the memoir reveals. There's a general passion and a particular passion. The general passion concerns the resentment and bitterness of agents of the Free French against the resistance. Cordier's memoir is possibly the most powerfully excoriating attack on the resistance ever written. An extraordinarily powerful document on the deep divisions, hatreds between the resistance and the Free French. For example, almost immediately after his arrival in France, Cordier is told by one of the Free French agents he meets, if the BCRA, that's to say the Gaullist Intelligence Services, is sending us here to organize the resistance, it's because the resistance does not exist. When Cordier responds that he's got two contacts in the resistance who have promised to be very helpful, the response is this: I hope you don't believe them. They have enough, you could read it, they have enough difficulties finding their own premises. You must understand that many of them are married, have children. They do resistance out of office hours. It's, for some of them, said you snobism. So try to organize this foutoir without them. Because what is more, they are dangerous, the resistors. It is not easy. Instead of thinking about the war, the leaders and resistors are only in politics. Watch out what the leaders want to do, etc., etc. They are not soldiers of the general. They will give you nothing. I advise you to do without them. Another person comments to him, the resistors are, they claim to possess an army, but they're just an army of clowns. Now, there are endless comments in this vein. There is nothing, in fact, more revealing of this contempt for the Free French, for the resistance, than Cordier's comment, the chasm, that when resistors talk to each other, they tutoyed each other. When Free French agents talk to each other, they tutoyed each other. But there was no tutoiement between the resistors and the Free French. And I could just add an anecdote here. When I organized a conference in London in 2010 for the anniversary of de Gaulle's Appel 18 Juin, and we had a lot of, we didn't actually have Cordier, but we had a lot of very distinguished, we had the Aubracs, we had Jean-Louis Crémieux-Briac, who was a great figure of the Gaullist resistance, who died about 2 years ago. And Aubrac was by then very diminished, very ill. Have I done something terrible? Is it okay? Do you want me to, will I cause devastation by, no, this thing's fallen down, does it matter? No, okay, right. Obviously you don't want to hear the rest. And Aubrac, I said to Aubrac, you seem quite tired, you know, would you want to lie down, have a siesta and so on? He said, no, I can't, because I don't want to let Crémieux-Briac have the last word. So there was this, and Cordier gets that. Now the second passion in Cordier's memoir, that's the general passion. The particular passion is his own personal resentment at the contempt and condescension with which many of the resistance leaders treated this mere boy whom Moulin had seemingly hired on a kind of whim. At every mention of Pinault, Christian Pinault, for example, Cordier describes Pinault's contempt and condescension for him. He said of Pinault, I never met anyone so infatuated with himself.
of Claude Bordet, number 2 of Combat, he says, "With this man of congenital coldness, I felt an unbridgeable distance." Of Emmanuel Dastier de la Vigerie, he said, I had the sense of not existing in his eyes. But worst of all is Henri Frenet. He says, when Moulin tells Frenet that the faithful Alain, that's Cordier's nom de plume, will be representing him while he's in London, Cordier shaking my hands, Frenet grumbled, "The resistance has fallen into the hands of a choir boy." On another occasion, when Cordier found himself unable to provide the funds for which Frenet was so desperate, he shouts at Cordier, "Your conduct is scandalous. What is your rank?" And Cordier says, "I realized he was preparing a dossier against me." So Cordier's book is a revenge against the resistance. It's the moment when he seems to reveal his hand and settle his scores with these resistors. It is a revenge made possible by the simple biological fact that he's the last man standing. Because all the other witnesses are dead, he has the last word. But he also capitalizes on the legitimacy that he has acquired as a historian. Because we trust Cordier the historian, we are more prepared to trust Cordier the memorialist. Now, whether or not this was a self-conscious strategy, his decision to begin with history and move to memoirs was a brilliant strategic maneuver. These two positions become mutually reinforcing. But one could reverse the proposition. Rather than seeing the legitimacy of the memoirs as supported by the seriousness of the historian, there is a kind of boomerang effect through which the memoirs unmask the historian. It had, of course, never been a secret that Cordier wrote from passion, but the emotion in the memoirs is more raw and it lets us look in a new light at the judgments of the historian. For example, we read his savage portrait of Pierre Brossolette very differently. And yet, just as Cordier seems to drop the mask of the detached positivist historian, one senses that there is another mask that remains intact. That there's another story about resistance that Cordier could tell us but chooses not to. For example, there's one mystery Cordier never fully addresses. Why, after just one meeting, literally one lunch, did Moulin, contravening orders from London, who had allocated Cordier to Bidault, decide to take on this young man, this boy, and make him his secretary? A decision for which Moulin was being criticized by London for many weeks afterwards. Later, when asked in a television program, "Why did Moulin pick you?" Cordier answered revealingly, parce que c'était lui. That's to say, the phrase used by Montaigne about his famous relationship with La Boétie. Now, Cordier later said that that was the stupidest thing he'd ever said. And that he preferred instead the more banal and plausible explanation that Moulin desperately needed someone to help him. And that Cordier had arrived at just the right moment. But perhaps Cordier felt that it wasn't just the stupidest thing he'd ever said, but it was more revealing than he wanted it to be. On the rare occasions when Cordier discusses Moulin's private life, he seems to suggest that Moulin was a womanizer, although he does refer to Moulin's strange marriage, which only lasted 2 years. Now, it's not my intention here to discuss the possible homosexuality, or at least bisexuality, of Moulin, for which the evidence is circumstantial, plausible, but certainly not conclusive, and the matter is anyway only of anecdotal interest. But behind that anecdotal question, there is a more general story that Cordier does not want to tell, even if he possibly offers us a teasing clue in the title of the memoir, alias Caracalla. Cordier had many aliases in the resistance. He was called Alain, Bip, Talleyrand, and so on. But Caracalla was not one of his aliases. He tells us at the start of the book, the memoir, that he chose to call it Elias Caracalla Because the name Caracalla was based on a character in the novel Drôle de Jeu by Roger Vaillant, who Cordier had got to know in the resistance in 1944. Now, Vaillant had been in the resistance, and his novel is a self-consciously Stendhalian, is written in a self-consciously Stendhalian mode, in which resistance is a kind of game, where seduction and friendship, patriotism and sex go hand in hand. But the only character in the novel who seems exempt from this game is Caracalla, on whom definitely Cordier is based. One character asks if Caracalla has slept with a girl, and is told no one knows because every morning he's away on his daily round of duties. The narrator says, Rodrigo loves Chloe, who loves Caracalla, who loves only the fatherland. Now, it was the moment that he published Elias Caracalla that Cordier himself came out as gay. But the book at the same time muddies the waters, because one of the themes of the first part of Elias Caracalla, apart from a short prelude which briskly dispatches his adolescent passion impure, is the young Cordier's infatuation romantically with a girl whom he calls Domino, whom he had met only a few weeks before his precipitate departure for London. And Domino dominates his thoughts for months until he discovers that she's got married, and then he gradually gets over it. Yet while ostensibly dreaming about Domino, his book is suffused with homoerotic undercurrents, and we are indeed told that Domino resembles a boy. And as Cordier describes the comrades to whom he became close in the intensely homosocial universe of the Free French, there is a continuous erotic undercurrent. He talks of one whose, quote, refined elegance and kindness and humour I found so seductive. Another, the feline and juvenile charm. Of another, he says he was handsome and his deep voice added to his charm. Of another, he was attracted by his mysterious grace and by his dimple. And there are also many occasions where the narrator, Cordier, seems to be living his desire through the sexual escapades of others. He describes one resistor with incredible flair. He continued in London his old habits, bars, girls, amorous exploits and sexual prowess. And with the same person, there's a hilarious story of how one day the flat of this young man in Lyon was raided by the Germans, but the raid was averted because this boy had the initiative just to take off all his clothes just as the Germans got to the door and start masturbating. And this traumatized the Germans that they thought it couldn't possibly be engaged in resistance activities and left the room. In other words, there is an undercurrent of undeclared... There's an undercurrent of sexuality going throughout the book. You might not think it's an undercurrent. I think it is, though. Now, writing about homosexuality under occupation has been too long obsessed with alleged affinities between collaboration and homosexuality, exemplified, of course, in the famous article by Sartre in 1945 on collaboration as a kind of sexual passivity. That writing drew upon the writings of some exiles of the Frankfurt School who had identified affinities between homosexuality and fascism, and on the reality that there were a lot of very famous French homosexual writers in the ranks of collaborators. But this has occluded another story that could be told about homosexuality and resistance. Is it not possible that the experience of leading a double life came particularly easy to homosexuals? That homosexuals were more likely than others to be alienated by the moralism of the Vichy regime? That having no families, or at least no children, homosexuals were freer of commitment? Or that having already made one break with convention, they might have been more susceptible than other members of society to make others? We know, to come back to somebody I've already mentioned, we know, for example, about someone I've already mentioned, Pascal Coppeau, the number two of Libération Sud. Now, Coppeau was always tight-lipped about his clandestine and often turbulent homosexual life, and he left no clue about how, if at all, it affected his identity as a resistor. Like many homosexuals of the period, he was a man of masks. On one occasion, in November 1941, Coppo turned up to visit his father, the famous theatre director, Jacques Coppo, great friend of André Gide, accompanied by a young man who might either have been an object of affection or a resistance comrade. Jacques Coppo, who knew about his son's sexual activities and probably suspected his resistance activities, wrote in his diary, "I am always very disconcerted when I raise the secret relationships of Pascal. I have an impression of committing a terrible indiscretion, touching on a word forbidden to me, world." Now, which world is he talking about? The world of homosexuality or the world of resistance? Coppo is, interestingly, the only resistor about whom Cordier writes with any sympathy, noting that uniquely he tutoied him. Nobody else tutoied him. But he never tells us, as he must have known, that Coppo was homosexual. Does Cordier's resentment against Freinet not perhaps betray his own half-conscious sense that Freinet's hostility to him was not exempt from a certain half-conscious suspicion of this slightly fey young man in the strongly masculinist universe of the resistance? The only open homosexual of whom Cordier talks is Denis Rake, the British SOE officer who spoke so movingly about his homosexuality in Ophüls' film The Sorrow and the Pity. Cordier met Rake while training in Britain, and he describes his outrageously camp behaviour. But even here, his description is slightly oblique and described as if by an observer who is in no way implicated. He said Rake would go into ecstasies at the sight of young Poles and Norwegians, many of whom were incarnations of juvenile beauty. There are other homosexuals in resistance who do not come into Cordier's story. Roger Stefan, 20-year-old journalist of Jewish origins, who had contemplated trying to go to London, but later said that as a Jew he did not want to seem to be escaping France. This background might have predisposed him in favour of resistance, but the factor in Stefan's own narrative which clinched his decision to go into the resistance was his love for a young man called Jean Sucel, who was working for the resistance. Having fallen in love with Sucel, Stefan, with the aid of Gide, overcame Sucel's inhibitions about his homosexuality, and Sucel, in return, overcame Stefan's reservations about joining the resistance. Apart from these cases, we can only speculate about the extent to which their sexuality might have influenced the motivations of other homosexuals in resistance. Jean-Louis Borry, Pierre Herbin, Robert Vibo, Noyce Van Moppes, and so on. Beyond this, we do not know much, and Cordier does not tell us. Even if at the same moment that he was studiously distancing himself from his homosexuality, at the same time he came out, and then 2 or 3 years ago he wrote this book, Les Fées de Saint-Hélène, which is a memoir about his homosexual experiences as a schoolboy. But Cordier was of that generation that lived its homosexuality uneasily, even if he was a member of the famous homophile organization Arcadie, which I have written about, where he, in fact, he used to be called La Veuve Moulin. In the highly masculinist narrative of resistance, in the highly masculinist post-liberation narrative of resistance, there was little place for homosexuality. Ironically, for example, Roger Stefan, who was one of the resistors who took over the Hôtel de Ville in August 1944, ironically, for his heroes of the resistance, a few weeks later, he found himself, after the resistance, he found himself arrested because he was soliciting a young man in a public toilet. He describes, so the irony is, for a young resistor who, he was imprisoned actually for resistance activities, soon after liberation finds himself briefly imprisoned for homosexual activities. And Stefan describes in his diaries how he found London in the late 1940s much more liberal for a homosexual than Paris, despite the fact that in Paris homosexuality was technically legal, while in London it was prohibited by law. As for the resistance hero Pascal Coppo, who I've mentioned twice, his attempt to embark on a political career after the war was sabotaged by a communist smear campaign which revealed his homosexuality. So perhaps Cordier then remains too much a prisoner of the assumptions and prejudices of that liberation moment. Like Moulin, he is a man of multiple masks who has lived many richly different lives. But after reading his memoirs, one is tempted to turn against him the question he once threw at Raymond Aubrac: what are you hiding and why will you not tell us? Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Okay,
if you're for that.
Yep.
You could certainly have another sip of wine.
Fine, thanks.
Questions arrive.
Of the television adaptation of Alias Caracalla. So there was, there exists this.
I've seen it.
Okay.
Which was nearest, there was going to be a full film, as I said, which a feature film was going to be made, and Cordier was so difficult about every detail that it didn't happen. So that's the nearest I've seen. And it's very well done.
Right, it's quite, yeah.
I mean, so what I would want to say about this, Cordier is a very, I mean, my plan is to write a book about him. He's a very complicated and slippery, I mean, he's a remarkable man. He's a man of three lives, but he plays with you when you he tells you what he wants you to know, and he's very much sort of verrouillé the story. And if you see, for example, I mean, just I was talking about the way in which he slightly exaggerates the moment of that debate with Gossier Lecon. And well, in the first place, he exaggerates in the sense that it's not true. If you look at the ENA archives, you discover that there are two other programs. He had been on television twice in the early 1960s, interviewed about programs about Moulin, so obviously he wasn't completely an outsider. And actually, when you watch that debate, and the clip I was going to show would have shown it, he turns out to arrive at the debate with an I mean, he may say that he felt completely ill-equipped to deal with the allegations of Frenet, but in fact, he seemed like a man who's been working on this, who's been working on the document for the last 20 years. So there is an element of, we can't believe all he says, and peeling away the layers of the narrative of his own self-clarity is very, very complicated. My hope is that, my hope is that when he dies, and I don't want to die off, I've actually written his obituary for the Guardian. When he dies, as I said, he's 98, his boyfriend, his partner was the French pop singer Hervé Villard, who he rescued from a sort of delinquent from basically the streets of Paris when Hervé Villard was 16. And they don't actually live together any longer, but they still remain quite close. And my hope is that I can get access to Hervé Villard. Because Hervé Villard has, through somebody that I know, told me, a man last year called Jean-Marie Besset wrote a book, a play, which I don't think is great, which I sort of went to some of the rehearsals of, and a performance in Montpellier in Paris called L'Evangile, Jean Moulin, L'Evangile, which is a complete outing of Jean Moulin, as it were. I don't really believe it, and so on. But this man, Besset, knows very well Villard. He tells me that Villard tells him that Cordier told him many things about the relationship, about the relationship with Moulin, which doesn't particularly interest me. But I want to access homosexuality and the resistance through Cordier. So I think there's an enormous amount to peel off, really. And sorry, this is really a crack now, but I think there's a very interesting story to write about Cordier as a patron of abstract Bernard Buffet, which is his big the person who was really selling in Paris in the 50s and 60s. So there are three, you know, there's a man who's had three completely different lives, which are very fascinating to peel off one off of the other, if it can be done. Oh, sorry, I'll put it back.
So I'm going to do the typical person who works on a different period, who has heard something you say that makes me think, oh, this is like something I know about, and it's going to take you away from your main subjects of interest, which is the quotation you had about documents and involuntary memory.
Yeah.
It sounds so much to me like the preface to Michelet's Histoire de la Révolution, in which Michelet says, every year when I step down from my lectures, so his lectures, he's been steeped in the documents, and then he finishes his lectures, and he goes off into the Place de la Sorbonne, and he feels that he's surrounded by the people who died in the revolution, and he can feel them everywhere. Yeah. And it seemed to me that that was just exactly what that text was evoking. And I wonder if, you know, if there's any sense of identification with Michelet and other romantic historians, or is...
I think that when Fevre wrote the things that I quoted earlier, he was obviously totally aware of those. So that... I've seen that... famous Michelet thing quoted quite a lot in those debates that I referred to earlier about how do you write the history of what are you doing when you write the history of the resistance. But I don't think Cordier, I don't think he plays the, you know, I'm this little naive person who was an art historian, who was a resistor, who was then an art dealer, who mixed with all kinds of he plays I'm the naive, unsophisticated person who's, you know, just doing this and so on, and I don't think he's steeped in that. I do think it's a wonderful quotation, and I know it simply because I've come across it in other contexts, but I don't think it informed his own. So he has a lot of different analogies if you start to read. I mean, that's one. Sometimes he talks about the taste of the past in another one and so on, which is what where I use the Proustian thing and so on. And then there's this, it's almost as he uses every sense, then the orchestra one about how only if you've been at the concert can you really know what the concert is like. But it is interesting, and I think that, you know, that debate between Jean-Pierre Vernon, who was obviously a massively sophisticated, important classical historian, and not Cordier, but with him, and what is the role of the historian writing about the resistance, is very interesting. And I wonder what Vernon would have said to your question, and I don't know, but...
This was so great. When that whole fight with the OPAC was happening, I remember thinking the fight about the OPAC hiding. I remember thinking that it was a very odd objection that there would be inconsistencies in their accounts of the past, because we all know what memory is like, and that OPAC herself, in the start of the book, talks about the fact that, well, you know, this is based on memory, and I'm telling the best I can, but there, you know, she sort of gives it away at the beginning that this is, you know, not meant to be, you know, the Bible. And so the fact that he picks up on this idea, it struck me as strange when this was all happening, but then when he came down to you hiding something, and then you pull it back to that at the end. So, you know, I'm just wondering if you think that even when he was challenging them, he was really talking about himself?
I don't know. I see what you're saying, and I don't know. I don't think he's self-reflective in that kind of way.
Okay.
And I don't think so. I think he was... but I think, you know, the Aubrac thing became... Because Lucy Aubrac actually wrote a history of the resistance in 1946, where she... And what's quite interesting is the way in which people who've written about that period do or do not insert themselves in it, or decide at some point they insert... Crémieux-Briac is another very interesting case. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people know, but Jean-Louis Crémieux-Briac, I think a great historian, became a great historian, but he was a young man, went to London and joined... De Gaulle, 22, an extraordinary story. I won't go into what happened to him. He worked for the BBC And he then wrote the classic scientifically authoritative book on the France Libre, which is a very fine book, you know, going to all the American archives, Canadian archives, right. British archives, and then only afterwards does he then write his own memoir of what happened. So this strategy of when you decide to be yourself and when you don't is quite an interesting one. Mm-hmm. And so that play between, you know, when you're going to reveal your hand and so on is interesting. And he's the one that Obrach said, you know, I can't let him have the last word and so on. But in specifically in answer to your question, I don't think he was thinking that. But I know, I think a lot of his stories had a problem with the... I mean, it did become... I can't understand as an outsider why... I mean, Henri Rousseau, Laurent Douzou, I don't know if people here know him, Laurent Douzou will not speak to Henri Rousseau because of that thing. Olivier Viviorca, again, I don't know, some of you may know him, but he said, the best decision I made was my wife's advice, don't join the panel. So he remained, you know, he was out of it and so on. So it really was, it caused, but I think it's partly because the Obrachs did. I think that when Rousseau says Cordier liberated us a bit, that they were kind of... traumatized by these resistors telling them you can't do this, and Rousseau's exactly my age, so obviously, you know, he's born in 54, so you know he's a post, you know, post were not implicated in it at all. But in a way, the previous generation, they had these people looking over their shoulders, and so the Obrachs, I know you say, well, everybody has faulty memories and so on, but the Obrachs did sort of play another role, which is, you know, don't contradict us. So they played on two registers, and then wouldn't, and in a kind of way, if you decide yourself to say I am inviting, because it was their decision, 10 historians round a table at that point, why were they doing it? They were doing it because they wanted that stamp of authenticity, and then so they were trying to instrumentalize, in a sense, historians. And I think therefore that when Rousseau said we felt liberated by Cordier, there was the truth in it. But to your specific question, I don't think I don't even know how much he knows that he's not telling the story. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know, because he's such a... I don't know him well, but whenever I've had conversations with him, he'll just he'll go like that. You know, just when you think you're getting him, he goes off somewhere else because he wants to tell the story in the way he wants. And I do believe, actually, that one of his things is he wants to... Again, I don't want to get... I'm not obsessed by Moulin's homosexuality. It's no importance. But I think he wants to protect the stature of Moulin, and that therefore... introducing homosexuality into his own story contaminates Moulin, and I think he feels that that would be a contamination.
The irony of wanting to protect Moulin, whereas other people want to protect the Obrach.
Absolutely, right. Yes.
Right. Oh, thank you. Anyway.
Sorry. Can't help being struck by the fact that these debates about Moulin, they coincide with the movement among French professional historians to write their Ego Histoire, and with Pierre Nora kind of encouraging people to do that, and with the same kind of phenomenon, you know, where Annie Kriegel, for example, writes an 800-page memoir, and she is a former resistance member, and also goes into great detail about her involvement with the militants in the Communist Party, which, of course, became the subject of her life's work. So are we dealing here with a broader cultural phenomenon, I wonder, that is not just specific to the issue possibly. Of the history of the resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Ego Histoire has been going on. I mean, that was that term which Nora coined, as he coins so... He's a great coiner, isn't he?
He is.
Goes back, I mean, I don't know when those Ego Histoire things started.
In the 1980s.
But, yeah, so it's been going on a long time. No, I don't think this is about... I don't think I'm talking about the same thing. I think that's something slightly different, because these aren't historians. These are people who, as it were, have become historians almost through the you know, what they found themselves living. So I don't see it as quite the same. And of course, in the French system, I mean, if you ever do an HDR, you know, habilitation dirigée recherche, you know that the HDR, they have to produce, I don't know how long it's happened, but I presume they've been doing it for a long time, they have to produce their own life story. I don't know about that.
It's relatively recent.
It's relatively recent, isn't it?
Yes.
And they are something quite, because we think possibly, you know, France is, because I think now the insertion of the I into history, we all do it, don't we now? It's almost, because we're so frightened of being omniscient, that we all have to put the I in. And, I mean, I suppose it's, you know, whatever, linked to postmodernism and lots of things, but there's almost no history now that doesn't insert, historian today, that doesn't insert the I, it seems to me. That's almost part of the genre, really. So I don't think that's necessarily just a French thing, but I think what you're talking, what I'm talking about is not about that. It's something different. It's about, you know, it's about the relationship between témoins who become historians and who then find themselves in this, it's got a privileged position, because they're gone. I mean, you know, Gordier is one of, when I say he's one of the eight remaining, that's like being a god, you know. He's been, the last Compagnon de Libération will be buried at Mont-Valérien, en fait. There's a special, you know, a special slot for them, and I don't know who the other seven are, but they, I've given this talk, one version of this talk before last year, when I gave that talk, I said there are 13 still alive. Now, checking for tonight, I thought I must make sure, and sure enough, it's now 8. So, but I mean, not surprisingly, you know, they're going. So, but yes, yes, I know. Yes, it's absolutely.
Yes. I think we may have time for one more question, and then we will have to allow our distinguished guests to rest.
All right.
You've circled around to where I wanted to ask my question around the order of the liberation. So de Gaulle, in a way, started this whole problem to some extent. Is there something special about the resistance that makes it difficult to tell the truth about it? And I really like the title of your talk because... and they, as you explained, the early actors in this story insisted that there was, that the resistance is an exceptional historical event that can only be told, the truth of which can only be told in a certain way. And presumably that conviction would have eventually died out over time, but then the Fernet thing happened, which gave it this amazing story that you just told. So I'm sort of left with the question of what your view is at the moment about whether the resistance is a special historical event around which the history, the telling the truth about it, does actually have a special quality, or whether that's kind of a myth and that people have been living on this myth for a long time.
I don't know. I mean, does it have a special... I think it matters. There are a lot of papers I've been to, you know, here, as we've all been to, and Johann's original introduction was about, you know, identity in France and so on, and there's a lot of nonsense talked about the myth of the resistance, I think that no one ever believed about the myth of, you know, that it was a myth and no one ever believed. And remember, we must distinguish between the resistant. I mean, no one had more contempt for the resistance than de Gaulle. You know, he had absolutely, I mean, de Gaulle's real views about the resistance were that they were very similar to that, really. And very few, and actually the number of resistors who became compagnons is very small compared to the number of free French. It was much more a free French order than it was. I mean, obviously the big ones get in, but others don't. I suppose it's an oblique way of answering, it's not really answering a question, but I do find, I think, a sort of thing I didn't explore here, the fascination, obsession with Moulin, in France today. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, I sort of compare it with JFK, really. And I wonder, there are two things that fascinate people about JFK, I think. One is the mystery of his assassination. You know, people, I mean, whether or not it's a mystery, I don't know, but, you know, everybody thinks it might be a mystery. So that's one thing. And the second thing, I think, that fascinates people about JFK is a sort of sense of a life, you know, he might have been a life cut short, you know, what he might have been. We can all invent possible futures for him because they don't happen. And I think there's an element of that with Moulin, that Moulin, not only is there the extraordinary mystery of, I mean, I think we really know what happened, but there's that question about who betrayed him, was he betrayed, what. And then there's this extraordinary figure, what would he have been? You know, might he have been some kind of, where would he have fitted in? I mean, you know, there was the Cordier, was one of the bankrollers of the Club Jean, you've heard of the Club Jean Moulin, you know, which was founded in 1958. The Club Jean Moulin was founded by a group of, when de Gaulle came back to power, obviously a lot of people thought that fascism was about to take over in France, and a group of former resistors, former Free French and resistors, Stéphane Hessel, who was a Free Frenchman, Cordier, Crémieux Briac, I can't remember who the others, formed, they actually started collecting guns and formed this Club Jean Moulin, which was going to be to resist the imposition of Gaullist fascism in France. Now, quickly they realized that wasn't actually happening, and so they turned the Club Jean Moulin into something else. And it became you obviously know about it, it became a sort of think tank and quite interesting and so on. But Cordier was one of the financial backers of it, which again shows he wasn't quite out of things as he claimed, but which again shows the talismanic quality that the name Moulin seemed to have. So, sorry, it's not answering your question, but I do think there's a lot to be said, a lot to explore about the multiple reinventions of Jean Moulin. I mean, all those books that I had up there, they're fascinating. But some of them are completely, I mean, there's one that is almost insane, but kind of compelling, because you know there's a certain kind of conspiracy theorist who is always right, because you... When there are mysteries, you know, somebody can, you can't prove that the CIA didn't organize 9/11 if you want to believe it, because the facts will always add up if you want to believe it, you know. And there is this man who's written this two books running to 900 pages each, showing that Moulin was about to betray de Gaulle to the Americans. But it's totally, every bit of the jigsaw fits, you know. So you can't tell him he's wrong. I've never met him, actually. But you can't tell him he's wrong, because he'll say, well, what about that fact there? You know, conspiracy history is fascinating. So I think Moulin, there's something interesting to write about Moulin as this, which is sort of a bleak way of answering the question about why Moulin really matters to the French today, I think. And he matters because of a kind of hope that the resistance seemed to incarnate, and then went, well, your books, partly your new books, all about that, really. And it didn't all happen exactly, or happen in complicated ways. So that's not really an answer.
Thank you very much.